Okay, thank you again. My name is Mary Willett. For those of you, I'm sure you've all been participating in the other first two sessions, so you know who I am, so I'm not going to go through that again. But what our goal is today is we're going to continue with our workshop on fundamentals of plant operations. And the workshop itself is designed for any individual that has responsibility in the governmental retirement programs, particularly those that have a fiduciary role in the plan. The course, the entire course itself mirrors the book that you've been given on operations, fundamentals of plan operations, and those are the, you're looking at the different topics that are covered in the book, and the textbook chapters we're covering in the third webinar is 5, 6, and 7 on plan amendments and special events, non-qualified deferred compensation plans, and the differences in operation of those plans, as well as we'll wrap it up just with a discussion on monitoring and evaluating your retirement plan and the responsibilities a plan administrator has in regard to that. So first, let's begin with a discussion of plan amendments and the administration issues that are involved when you're amending your plans or establishing certain different types of events, such as early retirement windows. So changes to the plan, there's various reasons why you may make changes to your retirement plan, whether they be a defined benefit plan, defined contribution plan, a primary retirement plan, or a supplemental retirement plan. Any changes that are made in federal laws and regulations, you need to be very aware of what those are and if that is going to require your plan to be amended or allow you to. There's certain provisions in federal tax law that may be mandatory and some may be permissive, meaning you have the option to incorporate them into your plan or not. The important thing to remember, mandatory amendments generally have a specific time frame by which, you know, any changes to federal tax laws occur and then become effective at the, maybe at the beginning of the next year. You have only a certain amount of time to amend your plan to conform to that. Permissive language and changes to federal tax laws, generally you need to amend your plan before you implement those permissive features. So it's in order to determine what's required, you just need to make sure that you carefully review and understand the changes in federal laws and regulations. State laws and statutes, often states may have certain provisions in their state laws that are specific in nature, and if the federal law is changed, you may also then have to seek changes to the state laws to conform to those changes. One example of that is when the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act changed contribution limits and made some significant changes in the Section 457 world. Often there were specific changes that needed to occur in state laws. Otherwise, if you implemented something in the federal laws that didn't conform to your state laws, you would be out of compliance either with federal or state. So I mean, it can be complicated. It's important for governmental plan administrators to understand what the requirements are in state laws as well to determine if additional amendments may be needed to conform your plan administration efforts to both federal and state provisions. Again, when we talk about the optional plan provisions, generally you are going to have to amend your plan during the plan year in which you're, when you're going to actually begin implementation of any of changes that are going to be made to your plan. So when you're looking at the process and timing for amendments, it's important to understand, particularly in regard to a permissive change to your plan. Mandatory changes, you just don't have any, you don't have much choice. I mean, you just have to develop a process to implement those changes that occur as a result of federal laws or even state laws that occur, and you're mandated to implement that into your plan. When you're looking at a optional provision and you're trying to make a change to the plan, either to better benefit participants or just to add additional features or flexibility to your plan, it's important that you look at the big picture. What are the goals that you're trying to accomplish and what objectives should need to be considered when you're looking at those amendments? You're going to generally want to include anybody in that process that has responsibility for the plan administration and communications so that they can be involved from the start as to how you're going to proceed with the change to the plan, and you know what kind of communication program you need to inform participants or to just help the people that perhaps are administering the program better understand what that change is, what the changes are. If it's something that is being considered and hasn't yet been decided on, before you get to that decision-making step, you should look at the total cost that's going to be involved, both from an employer perspective and perhaps even employee, you know, the participant perspective of what that change is going to, how that change is going to impact the plan and its participants. From a fiduciary standpoint, when you're looking at making changes to your plan, it is critical that you maintain complete and comprehensive documentation to identify what process you went through to determine if the change is in the best interest of the plan and its participants, and how you go about implementing it and making sure that it is thoroughly and accurately communicated to all those involved. The documentation is critical to be able to demonstrate that fiduciaries have actually met the responsibilities to the plan as it relates to any changes that are being made in the plan and the plan document. Let's look at some specific reasons why you might make a design change or implement a change into your plan. And one event might be an early retirement window. Early retirement windows are, they pertain to defined benefit plans. And what that is a way for the employer to allow individuals that may not otherwise be eligible for retirement, maybe they're earlier, it's maybe lower the retirement age, or maybe enhance the retirement benefit a little bit to encourage individuals to actually retire who might not otherwise be considered that an appropriate timing for them to leave. The early retirement window may actually be established because it's a workforce tool. Instead of looking at laying people off, if you need to reduce the workforce, particularly in the public sector, the early retirement window has been a way to avoid layoffs and to encourage the older worker perhaps to take on a retirement that maybe they had not anticipated for 1 or 2 years. Generally, an early retirement window is going to be based on the age and years of service of the individual. So if maybe an early retirement is the earliest retirement age is 57, maybe they lower it to 55 if they have 30 years of service, so that you're encouraging those individuals to go a little bit earlier. Regardless of, there's many ways to create an early retirement window, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, but however it is identified, it must be defined in the plan document. You need to make sure that it is clearly identified, all the restrictions, all the enhancements that are being made, and when and how that's going to apply to employees. Generally, it's only going to apply for a certain period of time. That's why the window term. So it may be a 1 or 2 year period that window is going to be open. Then there's additional incentive programs that can be used to adopt an early retirement window. One of the The incentive programs that might be adopted to utilize that window is to allow individual employees to buy additional years of service. Often it's, you know, if a plan offers airtime service, you know, where they can buy 1 or 2 years of service to increase their defined benefit in retirement, maybe they're going to, for that window period, allow one more year of service to be purchased, or they may change how that service is actually priced. It also might permit an earlier retirement age or lower the service requirement for a specified period of time. Standard early retirement provisions might have, you know, somebody that has 55 years of service with 30, for 55 years of age with 30 years of service can retire. During a window period, maybe they'll say, okay, at 55, if you have 20 years of service or 25 years of service, that It can also be an early retirement period, and that would be during those 2 years. Often there's also another way to create additional retirements is by providing cash bonus payments or other benefit enhancements that aren't necessarily tied to the pension during that retirement window period. The concern, however, in a retirement window, and it's something that plan administrators need to take great care to avoid, is to violate the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. What that is that it means that you cannot discriminate against people that are, you know, elderly. So if you offer something to individuals that are aged between 55 and 60, those same provisions need to be offered to anybody over 60. You cannot provide a window that lowers benefit for older employees. So any benefit enhancement that it's being made at, say, age 50 to 55 also needs to continue. There should be no end age, meaning that anybody retired during that window is going to get that once they reach a certain age. You don't want to cap it at a later age. That's one way to avoid violating the age with the ADEA. The textbook itself provides you with additional information on how to avoid violating the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. Sorry about that. And that even a legal case in 2005 that found that a school district would violated the ADEA with their window design. I'm not going to go into that, but there is more information in the textbook. So that there can be the variations on the window design can impact the minimum age and service requirement, the window period itself, whether it be 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. It also may be limited to certain categories of employees. The important thing to understand when you're limiting it to categories of employees, you cannot discriminate within that category. So I mean, meaning that if you're saying all teachers are available to go to retire during the window period, then it has to be all teachers. You can't discriminate within that category. But there is the ability, carefully structured, to limit windows to certain categories. And again, any window period that's implemented cannot produce a lower benefit for older employees. It's got to be something that if a lower age employee, a younger employee is offered that window, the older employees have to be as well. So the window should not be capped at the older age. Another optional provision in federal tax laws that a plan might adopt and which would require amending the plan if it's not already there is to allow public sector employees to use pre-tax dollars in a 401k, 403b, or 457 to buy service in a defined benefit plan. And they buy that service via a plan-to-plan transfer to purchase service in the defined benefit plan. And the reason for that is obvious. They want to be able to enhance their defined benefit plan and consolidate their retirement benefits from other employers perhaps, or even their supplemental retirement account as well. Any provision or any restrictions on that permissive service credit administration needs to be clearly identified and documented in the plan document through that amendment. You're going to list the type and amount of service that can be purchased, as well as any restrictions or limitations on the timing of when that can be made or how that can be made. Generally, an employer has a lot of flexibility in regard to how they establish that permissive service credit provision. But there's various and assorted types of service that can be used as to something that would be available to buy to add years of service to their defined benefit account. Previous public service, military service, if they have cashed out an earlier period of time in a retirement plan, often repaying that previously withdrawn contributions to add service is an option. Service with the employer prior to their eligibility, if they had a six months to a year period when they first were employed before they became eligible to participate in the plan, often the retirement system will allow them to buy that year of service. Some systems also allow airtime, which is for every 5 years of service with the entity, they can buy one additional year of service up to 5 years. And that's just a way for a retirement system to allow employees to enhance their retirement benefit by buying additional years of service. There's no actual period of service that's tied to that. There's some concerns in regard to that for some employers. It just needs to be carefully identified and clearly spelled out in the plan document. Another provision that is not optional, but often in federal tax laws, changes that impact the rights of our military personnel, those amendments would need to be carefully reviewed and then implemented within the plan design and the plan document and or statutory changes in the state if there's specific provisions within state laws that conflict with the federal laws. Let me get this straight. It's the Uniform Services Employment and Reemployment Act of 1994, which is USERRA. That's how it is referred to. It protects the rights of all employees who are called up into active military duty. And it protects them for employment as well as their benefits. It's not optional. Public and private sector employers must comply with this federal law. And there have been, over through the years, changes to it or additional regulations that have been implemented that do impact the rules and requirements under USERRA. It establishes specific timing and provisions in regard to reemployment, as well as it provides specific requirements in regard to their rights and the requirements that an employer must comply with in regard to employee benefits. There's two websites that are listed on the slide where additional information can be found about USERRA. Again, there's additional information in the textbook as well. But in general, employers are required to inform employees of their rights under USERRA, meaning that they have specific information that must be provided, and there must be specific, and it must be specific provided within a specified time period. So the Department of Labor has published a final notice that employers can post to meet this requirement, and there's specific information on the Department of Labor site that would help you meet that requirement as well. The rules under USERRA, it addresses the timing for any makeup contributions that have to be made once the individual returns to work, the timing of interest payments, the ability for people that have been called into active duty to make up deferrals that they had not been able to make because they were not getting an income from the employer, so the ability to contribute differential pay and as well as to make up those contributions in a supplemental plan like a 457, 403B, or 401K plan that they were not able to make during the period of their service. So USERRA is a very important law that employers must be and plan administrators must be very familiar with to make sure that their plan complies with these laws. And again, as regulations or changes to the federal tax laws or federal laws are made that impact USERRA, plan amendments may be needed as well. Cost of living adjustments, that is something that is generally more or less unique to public sector plans. It applies to defined benefit plans, and it's there to protect retirees' benefits against inflation. This is an area where, over the past 5 years or so, we've seen a lot of discussion in the public sector as a way to improve the general funding status of defined benefit plans. There's many systems that have looked at either reducing or eliminating the actual cost of living adjustments that's made to retirees' benefits. Generally, that's something that may not be as protected in regard to contractual rights to the benefits may allow employees to actually. May allow the employer to actually reduce their costs. There's generally two forms of COLAs. One's an automatic adjustment that's made one every year at a certain time of the year based on something that's established in the plan document. It could be based on a specific percentage amount. Some plan documents may say that they're going to give the employee retirees a 3% cost of living adjustment a year. Others might benchmark it to like the cost of living or the CPI that's published by the federal government, so that they're going to get 100% of the CPI adjustment or 90% of the CPI adjustment. Whatever is identified in the plan document would be, then be provided to retirees to increase their benefit on an annual basis. Another COLA that is often found is just an ad hoc adjustment that's made based on various criteria that might be established in the plan document. It could be based on the funding status of the plan. In Wisconsin retirement system, they base it on the earnings of the trust fund. So the investment earnings of the trust are recorded or are calculated every year, and the cost of living adjustment is based on that the percentage of earnings that the trust fund has actually occurred during that previous year. So there's various and assorted ways to initiate a cost of living adjustment, regardless of how it is that needs to be identified in the plan document. In the public sector, there's often the plan document may be more than one document. It could be the statutes. State statutes often are considered quote-unquote the plan document. Those cost of living adjustments are generally going to be identified in the plan in the state statutes for public sector state plans anyway. Another provision that may be part of the retirement plan itself is providing restrictions on the ability of retirees to return to work. Generally the problem with within the public sector of people that have employees that have a defined benefit plan, and the employer is seen as providing a retirement income through that defined benefit plan, and then these individual retirees return back to work, the thought is that the employee is receiving two benefits or two incomes from the government sector employer. They're getting a retirement benefit that's paid for by the employer, and they're getting a wage that's paid for by the employer. Not necessarily true, because the individual has already earned that retirement benefit. They actually may have actually paid for the part of that as part of their income. They've earned it, but the perception is that, you know, the term double dipping is something that often is used to describe retirees in the public sector that go back and work either in a temporary part-time job or just come back for a certain period of time. So that perception of the double dipping generates a lot of negative attention, either from the media, policymakers, or the general public, just because of how it is considered and the appearance that it's a double income from the same government employer, and then in essence it's the taxpayer dollars are giving these individuals both an income as well as a retirement benefit. The problem with that is that in today's the look of retirement is changing, and a lot of people want to retire and not really retire. They want to continue to work at least in a part-time job, or they want to transition into a more full-time retirement approach instead of just stopping work all at once. So there's a lot of ways that are being considered, a lot of things that are being considered in the public sector employment arena to help individuals that are the baby boomer generation, to how they're looking at creating some type of phased or transitional retirement approach in their retirement plans to allow these individuals to basically retire at least part retirement and part work. Restrictions on returning to work, however, there may be a lot of different ways that a public sector employer limits the ability of these individuals to return to work. They may limit the number of hours or the days they can work in a calendar year. They may cap how much they can actually earn in any calendar year, so that if earnings exceed a certain dollar amount, then their retirement benefit may be maybe stopped or recalculated based on the new earnings, and it's basically they're made whole, and then they have to restart their retirement benefit all over again if they exceed that cap. They may also only allow retirees to come back in positions that have a shortage of skilled workers. So if they can't find anybody to come to work as perhaps, let's use the category of teachers, there's a teacher shortage. So they for one, whatever, for whatever reason, they aren't able to replace the retirees with new teachers, they may say, okay, well, for the next 2 years, we're going to allow retirees to come back to work in teaching positions. I mean, that's another restriction that may be imposed. They also might say that retirees can come back, but only for temporary or short-term projects. And then also other restrictions might be that if you come back to work, your retirement benefits stop during the time of reemployment. Regardless of the restriction, these need to be clearly identified and spelled out in the plan document. If you amend your returning to work restrictions or the restrictions that are being imposed, then you need to amend the plan document as well to make sure that it's in there. Clearly communicating any changes to the plan document is a fiduciary responsibility. So whether it's any of these permissive provisions, or perhaps maybe the state laws have changed on how retirees can return to work and how that impacts the retirement benefit, communicating that change that's being made in state laws is a plan fiduciary responsibility as well. Another provision that is something that is only found in public sector plans. It is only allowed in public sector plans. And there's Department of Labor under ERISA. There's rules under ERISA that would prohibit private sector plans from implementing a deferred retirement option in a private sector plan. Since public sector plans aren't subject to ERISA, they have taken a much more flexible approach in regard to adopting deferred retirement options in a defined benefit plan. Deferred retirement options are a form of a delayed distribution from a defined benefit plan. The reason for adopting something like this is that it would be put in place to encourage employees to work beyond their early or their normal retirement age. Often in a defined benefit plan, once an individual reaches that normal retirement age, their retirement benefit may not increase for each subsequent year. They're basically penalized to continue to work because their benefits may not be increasing, at least not increasing at the same rate as prior to that normal retirement age. So they're encouraged in a defined benefit plan in some cases to retire as soon as they're eligible or as soon as their normal retirement age hits. In the 90s, this was a problem for police and firefighters because there was a worker shortage and they were finding it harder and harder to fill these positions because unemployment rate was low and there wasn't as many people coming into the workforce as there were going out. So they established, or they created basically I don't remember what entity it was that basically established this deferred retirement option plan, but there are more around the country now. It's not quite as common or popular today as it was in the 90s, but it still is there. What it is, it's a way that employers can use to manage their workforce. Actuaries don't like it because it's difficult to identify the actual cost of it. But just as a brief summary of how a deferred retirement option plan would be structured, generally it's only available to employees who are eligible to retire. They calculate the benefit based on today, say that I'm going to retire today, or I'm eligible to retire today, and I'm electing to use this, it's called a drop. And they calculate the benefit based on today, only the individual would not receive it. That value of that benefit, that monthly benefit, would be placed into basically a ledger account, and that account would be maintained just as a ledger account. There's no money that's actually being moved. There's no investment decisions that an employee makes. But the dollar amount is identified as a separate amount in a ledger account. And then the individual has said, I'm going to be in drop for 2 years. So I'm going to continue to work for 2 years. My retirement annuity is going to be identified and calculated and put into this account. And then at the end of the 2 years, I'm going to retire. When I formally retire and I actually leave work, I start receiving my annuity benefit that was previously calculated, plus I get a lump sum amount from that drop. Employers have a lot of flexibility because there are really no federal tax laws that dictate or regulations that dictate how a drop is established. So there's a lot of flexibility as to how that actually works, whether that individual then is forced to take a lump sum or they can add it back into their annuity to increase the value of that benefit for the rest of their life. So that would increase their monthly annuity by $50, or however it would work. The flexibility is there for the employer to actually design. That's one of the reasons why actuaries hate it, because costs for this benefit can be really difficult. But however it is structured, it is critical and crucial that the employer then incorporate all of this, all of the information about how the drop would work into the plan document and amend the plan accordingly and communicate this to employees as well. And then finally, just quickly, designated Roth accounts. That's another permissive feature in a 401k, 403b, and 457 plan, 457b plan, that allows employees to participate in the plan and choose to make either pre-tax deferrals, which are the normal deferrals to these plans, or after-tax deferrals. In a Roth account, in these plans, there are no limitations as to earnings limitations on who can make the contributions, all employees, all participants, if it's allowed, if the employer adopts this provision. All employees can choose to defer either pre-tax or after-tax. The after-tax deferrals into a designated Roth account, the earnings accumulate tax-free just like in a Roth IRA. Generally, plan sponsors need to make some certain considerations before adopting a designated Roth account in these plans. They need to, as a fiduciary, they need to make sure that it is in the best interest of the plan participants to incorporate this feature into the plan, as well as to look at how this is going to impact administration, record keeping, and communication, and the costs associated with the plan as well. So, I mean, the only decision that the employer can use, or the only requirement that the employer can then impose on making that decision, is what's in the best interest of participants to offer it. But the best interest of participants may take into consideration the costs and the complications that are involved with adding or incorporating a designated Roth account into their plan. Okay, moving on to Chapter 6. One thing that I forgot to mention at the beginning, we will take questions, and if you have any questions as I go through this and you want to make sure that they're captured, I'm not going to answer them until the end of the session. But if you want to go ahead, there's a chat box that you have with the webinar. Go ahead and type your question in, and at the end we will go back and go through any questions that you may have. So I prefer not to take them as we go, to try to get through the session first, but I will go back and answer any questions that any of you have at the end. Okay, so moving on to Chapter 6, Administering Non-Qualified Deferred Compensation Plans. Why would a public sector employer establish a non-qualified deferred compensation plan? Generally, non-qualified plans are more often found in the private sector, and they're trying to enhance benefits for certain individual employees or categories of certain categories of employees or certain individual employees. In the public sector, a non-qualified deferred compensation plan might be used in pretty much the same way. Think about football coaches, anybody within the public sector environment, top administrators, perhaps even elected officials that may have additional earnings that aren't considered in a defined benefit plan. That would be a reason why a governmental employer would establish a non-qualified plan. So non-qualified deferred compensation plans are much more flexible than qualified plans. They allow discriminatory practices. They can offer an unqualified plan to a single individual or a group of individuals. There's no requirement that they be non-discriminatory. There's less rules in regard to contributions and benefits, and particularly for public and private sector employers who have considerable reporting requirements don't apply to non-qualified plans. So in the environment of retirement benefits, non-qualified plans generally can be considered less costly and easier to administer for employers. Again, they might offer a benefit to only an individual employee or certain categories of employees, and as a rule, amounts that are deferred or amounts that are contributed in a non-qualified plan are includable in the individual's gross income unless they are subject to a substantial risk of forfeiture, and we'll talk about that more in a minute. The Internal Revenue, the federal tax laws were recently, a couple of years ago, there was an amendment, I think it was the Pension and Protection Act, I forget which law it was, I'm sorry, I should have written that down so that I remembered, but there was a section IRC 409A was established that provided more structure around non-qualified plans and more restrictions as to how they can be implemented and administered. The plans that are subject to 409A are any voluntary plans, voluntary deferrals of salary, bonus, fees, or any other compensation. So if that's a plan that's set up for an individual that's under subject to 409A, excess benefit plans, supplemental executive retirement plans, Section 457F plans, as well as severance plans. All of these types of plans are subject to Section 409A of the Internal Revenue Code. Certain advantages exist for the retirement non-qualified plans. I talked about those earlier. Is non-discrimination rules don't apply, so they can be discriminatory. There's no dollar limit on the amount of contributions or the amount of deferrals that can be made into a non-qualified plan. It's generally much more flexible and less restrictive than the designs of the plan than in a qualified plan. There can be vesting requirements and certain contingencies on when or how these monies can be paid out to employees, can be imposed on the non-qualified plan accounts without limitations. It's more likely that they will be subject to taxes earlier in a non-qualified plan than they are in a qualified plan. Generally, it can be structured so that the income tax is not applied on the assets until the assets are received or made available. And a big distinction here is that the individual does not have to actually receive the money to be subject to income tax. They just have to have the ability to access those assets, and the ability to access those assets triggers a taxable event. In a non-qualified plan, they are generally unfunded, meaning that there are no direct assets associated with the dollars that are accounted for as non-qualified plan assets. They always will remain in the ownership and control of the employer and subject to the general creditors of the employer. So in a private sector, this can be a significant concern for employees who have a non-qualified plan account, because should the employer go bankrupt, those assets then revert to the creditors of the employer, and the employee that has that account is basically a general creditor and gets in line with everybody else to determine if they're going to get any portion of those assets that they have been told are theirs. Contributions in a non-qualified plan, they can be made from salary, they can be made from bonuses, or incentive compensation that the employer just says, I'm going to provide to you in the form of a non-qualified plan. A bookkeeping account is maintained to track the participant accounts and any accruals that are made, any interest earnings that are applied to the account are also maintained in the bookkeeping account. Generally, there are no investments per se that an individual makes to the non-qualified plan assets. The earnings are applied based on a fixed rate. So the employer is going to identify that in the non-qualified plan materials, any adoption agreements that they have for the non-qualified plan. Then they will identify what that fixed interest rate will be, if any, that's assigned to those assets. The most common type of non-qualified plan that you're going to find in the public sector is an excess benefit plan. An excess benefit plan is something that must have another plan associated with it, a qualified plan, either a defined benefit or a defined contribution plan, where the excess benefit plan will provide a mechanism for any benefits that have been limited based on federal tax laws because of the 415 limits that are applied, whether it be on the benefit or on the contribution side, then the excess amount can be actually made into an excess benefit plan. So there's a coordinated effort between the qualified plan and the non-qualified plan to basically make the individual whole. And that's what's going to be, you're going to see in a public sector environment with the examples that I showed you about the football coach, basketball coach, top executives at a school district or hospital or elected officials perhaps. Maybe not as often elected officials, but you're going to see it a lot in the athletic departments, where they're going to establish an excess benefit plan to make up those additional benefits that had been capped because of the 415 limits. Another type of non-qualified plan that we see is mostly in the private sector. You're going to see mostly in the private sector is a supplemental executive retirement plan. This is also known as a top hat plan. A companion qualified plan is not required, and again, this is going to be generally unfunded, just like the excess benefit plan is going to be unfunded as well. In an unfunded plan, there's really nothing contributed to the plan. It's just a ledger account, bookkeeping account that shows the assets that are the account balance that has been assigned to the individual employee. One big concern with non-qualified plan is the doctrine of constructive receipt, and this is something that administrators need to be very aware of, because in regard to assets in a non-qualified plan, these assets are subject to immediate federal taxation when the income is constructively received. What that means is that if the individual employee has the ability to access those assets, even if they don't actually receive them, but they are able to use them as collateral for a loan, or if they have not made an election to postpone distribution, you know, to elect a distribution date, and they've terminated employment, and they don't take their assets, those assets, regardless of their actual taking ownership and having receipt of those assets, they still are subject to federal taxation. Generally, they're also going to be subject to state taxation, so that we need to look at that as well. In a non-qualified plan, if any of you are familiar with the 457 environment prior to the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act that changed 457B governmental plans to look more like qualified plans, some of these same rules applied to those early not deferred compensation plans under 457, where an individual had to make an election to defer compensation, and they could do it once a year. At least in a non-qualified plan today, they can do it once a year. They have to make it for the entire year, and that election to defer compensation can't be changed. They can't alter it. They also generally will have to pick a date to receive their distribution. Sometimes it is at the same time as they elect to defer. Sometimes also it's any time prior to when they're made available. Depends on the type of plan. The plan that you have, excuse me, I'm getting a message about you may be experiencing network difficulties. If anybody's having a hard time hearing me, please just raise your hand and I'll try to address that. So anyway, the elections to defer generally must be made by December 31st of the prior year for the coming year. There's generally two different type forms of contributions that can be made, either as a salary reduction or a salary continuation into a non-qualified plan. The difference between these formulas are salary reduction is an employee actually elects to defer their income, and they must do that before the timing requirements I previously stated, and they have to structure those elections. And I'm sorry if you're listening to my dog. I shut him up and he's still barking. Must be structured to avoid constructive receipt. Salary continuation is not an election to defer. A salary continuation is that the employer decides to pay additional compensation to an individual in the form of a non-qualified plan contribution. So the employee does not have any basis to take that amount as income. It's automatically made by the employer to them, to the non-qualified plan as compensation. This type of approach, if you've ever heard the term golden handcuffs, that would be through a salary continuation and a non-qualified plan. Payroll taxes is something that an administrator of a non-qualified plan needs to be very aware of when they apply. FICA taxes do apply on the compensation that's made to non-qualified plans. The timing of this is based on the later of the date the services are performed or when the amounts that are deferred are no longer to a risk of forfeiture. So the payroll personnel need to be very aware of when they should be deducting FICA taxes on those contributions to non-qualified plans. And it's important to know that deferred amounts may be subject to payroll taxes in the year after the work is performed and before the employee takes receipt of the assets. So there's specific information in the textbook about the payroll taxes and when they apply to non-qualified plans. And there's a lot of information on the website on the IRS website as well on non-qualified plans. It's very specific and can be accessed to help determine when exactly payroll taxes need to be applied. In regard to when distributions can occur from a non-qualified plan, timing as well as how the assets will be taken, whether they're lump sum distribution or installment payments or spread out over 5 years or however they want to receive those assets as a distribution. For a non-qualified plan under 401A9, they must identify when they're going to begin distributions and how they're going to take their distribution at the time of the initial deferral. So they don't have the option to say, I'll make that decision later. Under 401A9, they've got to do it right away. Deferred compensation can be distributed at one or all of these times as defined by the employer, separation of service, death or disability, a time specified by the non-qualified plan, or unforeseeable emergency as defined by the Internal Revenue Code. Those unforeseeable emergency provisions are very restrictive, similar to the 457B restrictions on the type of situations that apply for an unforeseeable emergency. Only the amount necessary to alleviate the financial emergency can be released under the unforeseeable emergency provision. And again, there are regulations that have been promulgated by the Internal Revenue Service in regard to, specifically in regard to the timing and requirements in regard to distributions, and that needs to be incorporated into any non-qualified plan documents that are established. When you're looking at how non-qualified plans are financed, the employer is not required to set aside funds to pay benefits. In fact, if they do set aside funds to pay benefits and label them as such, it can result in an immediate taxable event to the employee. Generally, they are a pay-as-you-go scenario where the employer pays the benefits as they come due and it comes from their general funds. So from the, in the private sector in particular, there's no assurances that the dollars will be there when they're promised to receive them. The employee runs the risk of losing that benefit in its entirety. There are some informal financing methods that are allowed under federal tax laws to actually provide a certain amount of comfort to employees that these non-qualified dollars, these non-qualified accounts will actually pay them a benefit. The importance is that regardless of the method, it needs to be carefully established to avoid the doctrine of constructive receipt. So whichever method is used, and there's a couple different ones like a rabbi trust, if you've heard of a rabbi trust, a sinking fund. Again, those are explained in the textbook. I'm not going to go through them on the webinar, but there are some explanations of different ways to fund non-qualified plans. But it's important to understand that regardless of the method, all of the assets in a non-qualified plan remain employer assets and subject to the general creditors of the employer. So they're never owned by the employee until they're distributed and taxable to the employee. There's two different forms of non-qualified plans for government and tax-exempt employers. The 457B plan of governmental employers, that's the deferred compensation plan that most government entities will offer and provide to employees as a supplemental retirement plan. It's an eligible deferred compensation plan, and it is most like a qualified plan. As a result of the EGTRA, some of the tax law changes that occurred in early 2000, these plans have been modified to look and talk and walk like a, more like a 401k and a 403b with the same flexibility, and the employees actually own the dollars. They're no longer the employer money. These are set up in a trust situation, annuity or I forgot about the third one, a custodial account, so that those assets are actually held for the employees and they are employee dollars. In a 457B plan of tax-exempt entities, however, these assets are not held in trust and they remain subject to the general creditors of the employer, and the distributions are subject to constructive receipt, meaning that they have to make an election prior to the time the dollars are made available to them as to when they will take a distribution. So they're basically the 457 plan of governmental employers prior to the tax law changes in 2001. They've retained, the tax-exempt entity plans have retained the more restrictive nature that was implemented prior to the tax law changes. Then we've got another one, the 457F plan, which is most like a non-qualified plan. It's considered an ineligible deferred compensation plan. It also is subject to some of the same rules that the private sector non-qualified plans have. So it needs to be carefully administered. So the 457B plan needs to be carefully administered to make sure it conforms and is administered as a 457B plan should be administered. As if it fails to meet the requirements of 457B, it is considered a 457F plan, and then it causes tax consequences for employees. So that's a big consideration when implementing a 457B plan, that you closely adhere to the federal tax laws that govern it to avoid being classified an ineligible plan under 457F. Okay, moving on. We have one more chapter in the course, and that's on monitoring and evaluating retirement plans. That monitoring and evaluating retirement plans is critical from a fiduciary standpoint. So the question I have is this different for defined benefit and defined contribution plans? It's not. There's different aspects of it. There may be different processes that are taken based on the type of plan it is, but in general, it is just as important for a defined benefit plan as a defined contribution plan, and vice versa. It's just as important for a primary plan as a supplemental plan. There are no differences. It's a fiduciary function that is something that all plan sponsors must be aware of and implement in regard to their overall administrative and operation process. one of the critical steps in a monitoring approach is to plan for what you're going to monitor and how you're going to measure effectiveness of the plan. How you do that is by setting some goals and objectives. For example, let's just look at one process that you might, if you want to evaluate your communication efforts for the plan, and let's talk about a defined contribution plan that has participant-directed investments, and it's a supplemental plan. So it's a choice plan where participants have the choice to participate, or employees have the choice to participate or not, and they have the choice to decide how much they want to put in the program or not. So if you're setting a goal for that plan to monitor that plan, some of the goals might be to identify enrollment percentages, how many employees are actually enrolling. You might want to have another identify another aspect of the plan as far as contributions. What is the contribution percentages that they are putting into the plan? How are they investing? That might be another item that you're evaluating and you're monitoring for effectiveness. And so you would want to identify how you're going to monitor, how you're going to determine what is effective communication and education to evaluate those aspects. Maybe you're going to set some benchmarks, some criteria that you're trying to achieve. Today you've got 25% participation and you want to get that up to 30% participation. Or you've got 50% participation, you want to get that up to 55%. In a primary plan, you're going to have different types of objectives and goals that you set for the plan and that you're measuring. Contractors, you're going to have specific things that you're going to put perhaps in their contract that you're going to monitor and that you're going to set specific goals and objectives for them. The reason why this is a critical step and a first step is that if you have well-stated goals that you have in regard to what you are monitoring, it allows you to provide standards by which you're evaluating the retirement plan going forward. One specific type of plan that you might want to establish, most plans are going to have various and assorted short-term plans, you know, for, okay, over the next year we want to accomplish X or we want to monitor this. But a strategic plan is something that is maybe done every other year, every third year, and you're looking at the big picture. You're looking at how the program is today, and you're looking at internal and external environments to determine what needs to happen over the long term to get you at a place you want to be. How can you make improvements? It's going to be broad in scope, and it's going to take into account any changes that you see that is occurring in your within your internal environment, meaning your participant population as your employees age. Are there differences that are needed in regard to distribution choices? Phased retirement is something that is often looked at in a strategic vision, how you're going to address people that are looking at a changing approach to retirement, and it should always be focused on the primary stakeholders. And the employer is sure is going to have some input into that strategic plan and that strategic vision for the plan, but the impetus, the reason why you are planning for the future is your participants and beneficiaries. And as a fiduciary, again, that must be your primary focus. When you're looking at the strategic plan, and what you're going to consider in that is you're going to look at both internal and external factors. Internal environment is the participant population, the employer population as well. If you have a multi-employer plan, if you have employee payrolls that are switching, you know, maybe going from a single payroll to a multiple payroll. So the internal environmental factors may impact your strategic plan. External environmental factors that you're going to want to consider in your planning process is any potential legislative and regulatory or policy changes. From a state perspective, you may have some things that are talked about this year that you think might happen next year or the year after that. Federal level, not as much happening over the past couple of years as 5 years ago, but there are still things that are being talked about. We talked earlier in the one of the earlier sessions about the changes to how fees and costs are communicated to employees and participants that are involved in a defined contribution plan, even though it's not something that's mandated for public sector today, that may be something mandated in the future. That's going to be considered in a strategic plan, and that might be something that is considered in the external environmental factors. Trends in the technology and investment industry, potential for changes in the inflation and unemployment situation, all of these items that are listed there under environmental factors are something that you're going to want to consider in your strategic planning sessions. So when you're looking at the specifics of monitoring a retirement plan itself, monitoring ensures that your goals are being achieved. So earlier we set the goals that we want to achieve in the plan. Now we're going to monitor them. We're going to monitor them based on the performance of the plan, and we're going to want to compare it to our goals that we've established, but we're also going to want to compare it to industry standards or peer standards or peer performance within other public plans around the country. So you're going to want to look at your plan not just internally, but you're also going to want to have an external source to measure and compare. You're going to have informal and formal resources to gather information and provide ongoing monitoring for the plan. Informally, you're going to want to periodically pick up the phone and call contract vendors and see how they're doing and see what's going on. Formal, you're going to have quarterly reports, presentations perhaps to a board, audits. Those are all formal methods for gathering information to complete the monitoring process. The written reports that are being provided for the employer, sometimes the employer generates themselves, the financial reporting that's being done for the retirement system, external companies that are part of your program, contract vendors, they're going to also provide you with written information, written reports. It's going to be more comprehensive than the informal oral reports that you're getting, and it's going to provide something that's going to help you document your fiduciary steps to monitor the program. So again, this is a definite fiduciary requirement in regard to making sure that you are able to demonstrate that you are meeting your responsibilities to the plan by providing documentation, a record of your monitoring steps. Benchmarking is something that is part of the monitoring process. You're going to create benchmarks to prepare specific tasks or products or services based on established norms and certain standards. Benchmarking, although it's something that you hear a lot talked about in regard to investments, you're going to have an investment product that's a large cap stock fund, and you're going to benchmark it to the S&P 500 index and perhaps some other peers within that similar fund environment. Benchmarking is not just, however, on investments. There's other ways, there's other tasks, there's other services that you're going to look at that you're going to want to benchmark as well. Benchmarking performance of the promptness of getting out benefit estimates or answering phone calls in a call center. There's a various and assorted tasks within a retirement system, within a customer service environment, within the reporting requirement, or within processing that you're going to actually establish specific goals and benchmarks that need to be met. Gathering data is an important step in providing that benchmark, as well as surveying others within the industry and providing comparisons to national or regional standards on that task or that product that you're actually benchmarking. I talked about monitoring investments. It's critical that investments be monitored to ensure that you are they're consistent with your written investment policy that you've adopted for the plan, whether it's a defined benefit plan where you actually have an investment policy governing how the trust fund assets are invested, or a policy that's focused on how the investment menu will be established. If there is inconsistencies, then you need to make sure that you amend your written investment policy statement. So if you don't monitor that statement, if you don't monitor the investments of the plan, you will never know if you need to make changes to your investment policy. Monitoring includes measuring the performance against established standards and benchmarks, but it needs to also consider costs that are associated with those investments to ensure they're reasonable and appropriate, and they are not something that is impacting the performance of the fund unduly. Administration, in addition to investments, you need to monitor the administration of the plan. It's going to involve both qualitative and quantitative measurements, and you're going to want to look at the expectations you have for that administration of the plan compared to how it actually has performed. One way to actually monitor administration is to actually review the participant activity for the specific functions within the administration of the plan, and communication and transaction processing is also considered in the monitoring role. So you want to monitor how effective your communication is and how participants have actually benefited from any communication or education that's provided for that program. Audits. We talked about audits earlier when we were talking about one of the other chapters in the book, but the SAS 70 audit evaluates the systems and the control policies and procedures that's relating to the financial and transaction processing of the plan. SAS 70 audit may be provided by vendors if you have an outside vendor that's doing the record keeping, or it may be something if you handle it in-house that you contract out to have someone actually perform this audit for you. Compliance audits are important. They may not be done every year, but they are important to make sure that you evaluate how well the plan is complying with federal and state laws, as well as how well your contract vendors are providing with the provisions that have been established in their contract. Do they actually do what they say they are doing, and are their transaction processing actually meeting the requirements that you've laid out for them? A financial audit examines the financial transactions of the plan and generally will be done every year. Financial audits are generally part of your employer financial statements, and those audited financial statements in the public sector are something that is prepared every year. In a defined benefit plan, there's also going to be actuarial audits that monitor and evaluates the services that are being performed by actuaries. So that actuarial audit is also critically important to make sure your actuaries are accurately depicting how the plan looks, so that they're actually preparing your contribution requirements appropriately. In addition to the administration, there's other service providers that you may need to monitor in regard to the plan. In addition to record keepers, you've got investment advisors and counselors. Anybody that you hire to help you with the plan needs to be monitored. Accountants, actuaries, consultants, even attorneys. They may not like it, but you should be able to create some type of goals and strategy to perform some monitoring of anybody that you hire to help you with the plan. We talked a little bit about monitoring communications. That's a really critical step, particularly when you're looking at a defined contribution plan where participants are subject to making their own decisions about how to invest or even participate. In a defined benefit plan, the communication priorities are somewhat different because you want to make sure that they understand the benefits that they're being provided and their choices within the benefit, but there may not be as many, at least upfront, decisions that they need to make. They're basically in it, and their contribution limits, if they have any, if share of the contribution that's being paid by them, it's mandatory, they don't have a choice. So in a defined contribution plan, initially there's a lot more choices that an individual must make, and communication includes education on helping them make that investment decisions. It's critical in the monitoring step to monitor a communications plan is to conduct a statistical analysis to determine how effective that communication program is. But in addition to just statistical analysis, you're also going to have some other tools available to you that you should consider, including surveys. Surveying your participant population to gauge how well they think that the effectiveness of the education that's being provided to them, what they feel they need, or additional assistance might be needed for them. If they are provided with all the choices that they need, whether it's investment choices or distribution choices, and evaluate how the plan is compared to other plans. So you may do a survey national organizations like the National Association of Defined Contribution Administrators, or NAGDA, does an annual survey on plans. Those types of national surveys can help you compare your plan and its data and its statistics to plans around the country that are similar in size and nature. An additional method that you can use from a monitoring, particularly in regard to monitoring with employees and participants, is to do focus groups. And focus groups can be used to evaluate and new plan changes, new plan design, things that you're looking at to enhance the plan, as well as just how well the plan is administered today. So in a focus group, you're going to use a moderator with 8 to 12 individuals that are selected based on certain demographics or certain types of participants that you're looking to actually evaluate, and you're going to get their opinions and attitudes about specific topics, services, products, or their experience, and that the results of that can actually help you either enhance your plan or perhaps make changes to it that you hadn't considered in the past. So with that, I've wrapped up this course for you. I hope that you have gotten out of this what you hoped you'd get out of it. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them for you. You can always email later if you don't have any right now. And before you go, and while you're thinking of questions, and feel free to type them in that chat box. If you don't feel like typing them in the chat box, there's a little hand you can raise next to your name, and I'll watch for that as well. So you could raise your hand and I'll unmute you so you can actually ask it. And then at the end of this presentation, when you sign off, you will get a message that pops up to complete an evaluation. So please complete that. This is the second course that InFree has provided in the Retirement Administrator Series, and your input will really help us going forward to see how we can change it, how we can improve it, and better meet your needs. So please complete the evaluation, and if you have any questions, like I said, type them in the chat box or raise your hand. And if I don't see any questions, I think, gosh, I must have really done a good job, because nobody has any questions. I answered everything you might have through the session. If you have any questions about any of the other about the first two, maybe you've gone back to after you left the webinar, either part one or part two, and said, gosh, I didn't have that question answered. If you've got something about those two seminars as well, webinars, I'd be happy to answer those as well. I'm not seeing anybody with their hand raised. Okay, we have a question. Why would a governmental higher education employer choose to use a 457F versus 415 excess plan as a non-qualified plan option? The only reason that I could see that they would choose a 457F versus a 415 is that they didn't have a primary retirement plan, a qualified plan, that's a companion plan to it. An excess benefit plan is actually, an excess benefit plan is administered in conjunction with a defined benefit plan. So if the defined benefit plan administrator, plan sponsor, is limiting or capping the benefit, sometimes it's easier to just use the coordination of that DB plan for the excess plan as well. 457F plan is totally separate, totally independent, and there's no caps on the amount that they can contribute, right? But there is additional restrictions on the 457F that might not be in the 415 excess plan. Off the top of my head, I really can't give you any more specific information about that. That's not my most comfortable area of expertise to talk about, and I don't want to give you misinformation, but that would be my initial opinion as to why a plan would choose a 450. Well, I would think they would prefer a 415 excess plan over a 457F. Anybody else have a question? Okay, well, I appreciate you all staying on and participating, and the next webinar series will be on investments, and I believe that starts, I'm not sure on the date in January, but that starts in January, and you will have a break from me. There's a different presenter, so I probably will be back in, what is that, January, February, March is investments, and then the April, May, and June will be the final series on compliance and ethics. So thank you very much for your time, and with that, I think we will go ahead and end this session. Thank you.